All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, May 9th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a lovely 64 degrees, sunny and very springy here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Lab in the Cloud, Bioweapons, Smallpox, Mycoplasmas, and Project Daylily. And we had taken a look at some of the United States' biological warfare program of the past, Fort Detrick, Maryland, and some of the things that they had been doing over in Japan, as well as in some of the former Soviet countries. We also discovered that Merck became the head of the U.S. Biological Warfare Program. He was appointed the very first. And then our Biological Warfare Program never actually ended. It just transformed into genetic engineering and some of the other things that they are doing, all in the name of curing cancer. We had also discussed this organism called a mycoplasma that I had come across while reading the Project Daylily book. One of the things I never really explained is what Project Daylily was all about. Not only had it isolated these mycoplasmas as the root cause of some very mysterious diseases that seemed to be prevalent in the population, but it was also a bunch of researchers who were trying to help the Gulf War veterans, because one of the scientists' daughters, I think it was his stepdaughter, had gone over in the first Gulf War and had been quite a successful individual as far as her drive and her ability to accomplish things. And when she came back, she got very, very sick. So they started taking blood tests. And his wife was also a scientist, a biologist, or a, I don't know what they were. They were scientists that had petri dishes and test tubes. They took blood tests and they tried to isolate, probably hematologists of some kind. They tried to isolate the pathogen. But one of the things that they had discovered, because it wasn't just her, it was her entire platoon, is that they were all infected with the super potent mycoplasma. We also discovered that there was another scientist who was working at one of the hospitals and universities that these same scientists were, that were under contract with the military. And they were doing human testing on subjects in Texas prisons with these mycoplasmas. Long story short, there were many attempts on these scientists' lives, but they had shown how this mycoplasma that was very, very stealth, and it mimicked all kinds of other diseases, could infiltrate the human body, wreak havoc, and systematically enter each cell, slowly kill it by killing the mitochondria, which is the power center of the cell, and then move on to the next one, mimicking all kinds of degenerative diseases. Now we're going to continue. We're going to look at more diseases and infections and very strange things that we might not even realize they've been working on. But I discovered some stuff that scared the pants off me over the last few days, so I'm going to share it with you. Now, of course, one of our love-to-hates are any of these entomological disease vectors that supposedly, wink, maybe accidentally or on purpose, were released from places such as Plum Island, where they had done lots of entomological research. They had had a Dr. Blom at that facility, who had actually come from Germany, if I'm not mistaken, from their biowarfare program. And they got him to work on different types of vaccines, because we were allowed to still work on vaccines in an offensive posture. Once we inked that chemical and biological warfare edict saying we would no longer work on those projects, Dr. Kurt Blom was a high-ranking Nazi scientist before and during World War II. He was the Deputy Reich Heath Leader and Plenipotentiary for Cancer Research. How convenient. In the Reich Research Council. His autobiography, named Arts im Kampf, he equated medical and military power in their battle for life and death. And I don't think we've gone much further than that, because that's exactly where we are at this point in the name of biological warfare. And it's all stealth biological warfare. And it's all being sold in the name of curing you. And remember, problem, reaction, solution. There has to be a big illness for everybody to step right up and get their shape-shifting immune system antiviral shot that will cure you of the next major pandemic. Remember, Bill Gates came out just a few days ago warning again of a global pandemic that could kill billions of people. Well, Bill Gates has always been a visionary, and I put that in quotation marks. Bill Gates is well invested in a lot of this research. All right, back to Kurt Blom. Blom had a longstanding interest in the, quote, military use of carcinogenic substances, as well as in cancer-causing viruses. Oh, really? I remember we learned a long time ago about, and I don't remember the name, Dr. Mary's Monkey, I think was the name of that book, where they had been researching fast-acting cancer-causing viruses back in the 60s to take out leaders such as Fidel Castro. That was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyway, biologists under Hitler in 1942, Blom had become director of a unit affiliated with the Central Cancer Institute at the University of Poznan in Poland. And although he claimed that the work at his institute involved only defensive measures against biological weapons, wink, where have you heard that before? The director of the institute strongly supported the offensive use of chemical and biological weapons against Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States. According to another scientist named Cluey, Typhoid, cholera, and anthrax were all being developed as weapons, as well as a new synthetic medium for the spread of these bacteria, which would allow them to remain virulent for 8 to 12 weeks. So not just a flash in the pan. They're going to be percolating everywhere. And, you know, this is something that we're going to look at today. Hopefully I don't get too lost in this Wikipedia entry. Blohm worked on methods of storage and dispersal of biological agents like plague, cholera, anthrax, and typhoid, and also infected prisoners with plague in order to test the efficacy of vaccines. Now, again, where have we heard that before? Remember, we learned a lot of our tricks from these other biowarfare programs that were going on in these other countries. Project Paperclip, we brought a lot of these guys back here to help us develop not only biological warfare, but also some sort of space program. At the University of Strasbourg, a special unit headed by Professor Eugene von Hagen and employing researchers like Kurt Getzelt and Arnold Doman tested typhus, hepatitis, nephritis, and other chemical and biological weapons on concentration camps. Gitzig was in charge of hepatitis research at the German army, and his colleagues carried out virus experiments on mental patients, Jews, Russian POWs, gypsies, Auschwitz, and other locations. And in 1944, Himmler also ordered Blohm to experiment with plague on concentration camps. And again, you know, guys, I mean, say what you will about some of the things that they did in Nazi Germany, but I still don't doubt that they used humans for experimentation for some of their biowarfare. We did it. And we didn't even have concentration camps that we were working on. We were just spraying it over the American public. All right, so now the next step, the use of insect vectors in biological warfare. And we have talked about entomological bugs, biological warfare before. In 1943, Blohm proposed spreading malaria artificially by means of mosquitoes. Oh, where have we heard that before? And experimented on prisoners with lice in order to cause typhus epidemics. Edward May, director of the Entomological Division of the SS Institute for Practical Research and Military Science, received a commission to experiment on prisoners with, quote, humanly harmful insects, starting in October of 1943, which was closely connected to Blohm's biological warfare program. All right, so now let's continue one step further. There's a new warning titled Tick-Borne and Mosquito-Borne Illnesses Are on the Rise in the United States. This is out of sciencemag.org, May 2nd, 2018. Illnesses spread by ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas more than tripled in the United States from 2004 to 2016, going from 27,388 reported cases to 96,075, says the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Tick-borne ailments such as Lyme disease, which is another one of these creepy little diseases that hides in your joints and slips away, is not respondent necessarily to antibiotics. Lyme disease accounts for more than 75% of reported cases. And now that there is warmer weather, there is going to be an explosion of these vector-transmitted diseases as ticks thrive in areas once too cold, but now with global warming. And mosquito populations mushroom like a nuclear cloud during heat waves. Trade and travel to and from tropical locations where disease-carrying critters can survive year-round is also to blame. And it is now an epidemic. So look out, people. So now let's take a look at entomological warfare. Because there is a question where some of these diseases, such as Lyme, came from. Entomological warfare is a type of biological warfare that uses insects to attack the enemy. The concept has existed for centuries, and research and development has continued into the modern era. Entomological warfare has been used in battle by Japan, which is another nation whose biological warfare research we pilfered after World War II, as well as several other nations have developed and been accused of using entomological warfare. Entomological warfare is a specific type of biological warfare that uses insects in a direct attack or as vectors to deliver a biological agent such as plague or cholera. And you know, you still have plague-carrying ticks in the West. Essentially, entomological warfare exists in three varieties. One involves infecting insects with a pathogen and then dispersing the insects over targeted areas. Now, didn't DARPA have a program that was similar to that? It was called the... Oh, hold on. Let me think for a minute. Oh, it was something like friendly bugs. I don't remember. Oh, damn. Hold on. DARPA bugs. We'll have to figure this out. Oh, here we go. Yeah, DARPA already had something like this. Leave it to DARPA. DARPA enlists insects to, of course, protect, not damage, the agricultural food supply. And remember, it's always a double-edged sword. New program aims for insect delivery of protective genes to modify mature plants within a single growing season. Yes, they're going to genetically modify plants over one growing season, which this sounds a lot like gene drives to me. It may not be obvious to humans, but the life of a plant is full of peril. Viruses, pests, fungi, herbicides, drought, pollution, salinity, flooding, and frost. And the plants that we depend upon for food, clean air, and materials are now challenged by a myriad of threats, natural and man-made. And remember, gene editing is now a WMD. By extension, human populations are, of course, put at risk when food security is challenged and the agricultural underpinnings of our economies are destabilized, especially when threats emerge rapidly or unexpectedly. Farmers and others responsible for plant health use long-standing tools such as crop rotation, selective breeding, pesticides, slash and burn cleaning, and quarantine to shelter plants and defend against the worst pathogens, pests, and environmental insults. But these can, of course, be slow, inefficient, and damaging to the environment and may require extensive and expensive infrastructure. While scientists and farmers are increasingly turning to molecular techniques to improve resilience in plant varieties, today's genomic tools generally do not allow for alterations of mature plants in vivo. I don't know if in vivo can be used for plants, but that would be in a living organism. A new DARPA program is poised to provide an alternative to traditional agricultural threat response using targeted gene therapy to protect mature plants within a growing season. DARPA proposes to leverage a natural and very efficient two-step delivery system to transfer modified genes to plants. And that would be utilizing insect vectors and plant viruses that they transmit. In the process, DARPA aims to transform certain insect pests into insect allies. That was the name of the program, in the name of a new effort. The insects eat the plants, and then the insects transmit the majority of the plant's virus, says Blake Beckstein, the DARPA program manager for Insect Allies. DARPA now plans to harness the power of this natural system by engineering genes inside of the plant virus that then can infect the insect, that then can infect the plant, and be transmitted to confer protective traits to the plant while they are being fed upon by the insect. So all they got to do is nibble on the plant, and they'll infect the insect. How about when they bite you? Insect Allies has three technical areas. One is trait design, one is insect vector optimization, and that's making superbugs, and the last is selective gene therapy in mature plants, layering together to support the structure of the goal of rapidly transforming mature plants to protect against natural or intentional or accidentally on purpose agricultural disruption without the need for extensive infrastructure. The foundational knowledge and generalizable tools developed under the program could also support future agricultural innovation. And I'm going to add biowarfare to attack another nation. One of the most effective and existing methods for protecting plants, which would be selective breeding, typically involves 5 to 7 years of work. Genetic modification of plants has historically only been done to plant embryos inside of the laboratories using tissue cultures, just like humans, and transforming mature plants en masse, like they want to do to the human population, would be an enormous achievement and pave the way for future breakthroughs in agriculture. Insect allies will emphasize biosafety and biosecurity, wink, and all work will be conducted inside of closed laboratories, greenhouses, and other secured facilities, so they say. DARPA's proposer day was November 18th, 2016 in Arlington, Virginia. And who knows where that has ended up, but believe you me, entomological warfare never ended. So, I don't know, we're not going to get more into entomological warfare. We are going to continue on DARPA. So, DARPA, then named back in February of 2018, researchers to work on a brand new program that will halt outbreaks in 60 days or less. And this was the Race for the Cure. Hold on, I wanted to find, too, Billy Gates's newest announcement. Because it just seems pretty convenient to me that Billy Gates comes out again and pushes those buttons. This is April 28th, 2018. This is a couple weeks ago. Businessman and philanthropist Bill Gates has made infectious diseases one of his signature issues, funding efforts meant to tackle threats like malaria and, of course, those mosquito-borne diseases. And he is investing in gene drives as well to genetically modify and tamp down on reproduction of an entire species. There was two different ways they could do that. One was population suppression, and the other one was population elimination. And we discovered that when digging deep into gene drives one day. On Friday, and this was 2 weeks ago, he emphasized his call for focusing on the threat of pandemic diseases. Gates compared the risk of pandemic disease outbreaks to the challenges of preparing for a massive war and argued that we have now fallen behind in readying our public health system for an epidemic that could kill 30 million people in just 6 months. Oh, not that we're working on anything like that down long, dark hallways. No, we're not. So don't worry about that. Remember, Billy Gates is in the know. Billy Gates is pushing this agenda. In the case of biological threats, that sense of urgency is lacking. Gates told the audience that the world needs to prepare for pandemics in the same way we prepare for war. Gates has spoken with national security leaders in the past about the risk posed by infectious diseases. And he has meetings. He had meeting with President Trump. And remember, we read about that on Friday. Maybe he even got a job offer to take over the science section. Gates argued that he is well qualified, but we need to be able to coordinate a large scale approach to a coming threat. Now, DARPA is also working on halting an outbreak in 60 days or less. And remember, it's always a double-edged sword. As DARPA is working on cracking the secrets of biology, they are also learning how to damage biology, enslave it, and co-opt it for their own purposes. Advances in medical countermeasures have formed a strong foundation. And this is with DARPA's ADEPT program, and that's the Autonomous Diagnostics to Enable Prevention and Therapeutics. It has enabled the creation of a true end-to-end pandemic prevention platform, and this is called the P3. However, experience gained from conventional responses to emerging infectious diseases has demonstrated that significant bottlenecks hinder the rapid response to an emerging infectious threat. This P3 program seeks to demonstrate an ability to rapidly produce virus needed to test and evaluate therapies. Yes, rapidly produce viruses because we need to use them to test and evaluate therapies. Obtain high-potency antibodies within the first weeks of an outbreak, and then scale our production and delivery methods into humans to produce protective levels inside of the patient. So let's find ways to very rapidly produce viruses. This is just sick. So this is this P3 platform, P3 performers. And this would be the different institutions that are bidding on working on this project are expected to demonstrate safety of their nucleic acid products. This is going to be DNA and RNA that they are messing around with against one target pathogen in a phase one clinical trial. And ultimately, the performer teams, well, I wonder who's going to step up for that. The performer teams will be evaluated on results of their clinical trials and their ability to compete with the end-to-end process within 60 days from the time the pathogen-containing sample is first obtained. Also, to demonstrate the broad utility of this P3 platform, each team will target a variety of viral pathogens, including influenza, chikungunya, MERS, and the Mayaro virus, among others. All right, so where do we go from here? So DARPA is going to task a large group of scientists with developing large amounts of viruses and then coming up with a cure and then doing a clinical trial all within 60 days to thwart a potential future pandemic threat. They also have a program, and this came out the day before, February 1st of 2018, Reading the Body's History of Threat Exposure. We've read about this one before. I think we touched on this a few shows ago. Again, epigenetic technology would provide a new tool in the fight against WMD proliferation. Now, remember, they have tagged CRISPR, and that was Klepper. They've tagged CRISPR as a weapon of mass destruction, gene editing, accidentally or on purpose, by rogue actors. Because this technology has been democratized across the world, and we now have laboratories in the cloud that any Yahoo, they don't even need a rented garage or mommy's back bedroom anymore. They could just push the stuff up to the laboratory in the cloud and develop, I don't know what type of biosecurity they have up there, but develop pathogens that they could potentially release into the environment. So we're going to talk about that here in a couple of minutes. So back to this epigenetic technology to provide tools in a fight against WMD proliferation, and that would be some sort of gene editing technology, just like insect allies, but in humans. Picture an intelligence officer in the field. They are trying to piece together a suspected threat and has access to someone who may have a role in carrying it out. There may be traces of biological or chemical agents in their clothing or their hair, and they can look for them, but they are transient and often present in such low concentrations that they'll need to send samples to a laboratory. They can check their epigenetic markers, read a history at any time if they've been exposed to a threat agent, and they could start piecing together a chain of evidence right in the field in real time with some of this new technology. DARPA's new epigenetic characterization observation, more affectionately known as ECHO program, aims to build a field deployable platform that quickly reads someone's epigenome and identifies signatures that indicate whether the person has ever, in his or her lifetime, been exposed to materials or bioagents that could be associated with weapons of mass destruction. Or maybe to just test whether or not you've been one of the unlucky few that has been infected by their biowarfare agent that they let loose one day accidentally or on purpose from one of their biowarfare labs. The epigenome is biology's record keeper, and though DNA does not change over a single lifetime, a person's environment may leave marks on their DNA that modify how an individual's genes are expressed, and they'll be flipping those switches on and off. This is one way that people can adapt and survive in changing conditions, and the epigenome is a combination of all these modifications. Though modifications can register within seconds to minutes, they imprint the epigenome for decades, and we even read the epigenome changes can be passed down to offspring as well. So if one of your grandparents or great-grandparents lived through the Great Depression, you may have some sort of tendency with a switch or two flipped off or on in your DNA that causes you to be harder or to save food. We actually read a story about that, some research that they had done. But it can imprint the epigenome for potentially decades, leaving a timestamp biography in an individual's exposure that is difficult to deliberately alter. Whereas current forensic and diagnostic screening and technologies can only detect immediate presence of contaminants, this envisioned echo technology would read someone's epigenome from a biological sample, such as a finger prick or a nasal swab, to reveal possible exposure to WMD or WMD precursors, even when other physical evidence has been erased. Yeah, they're going to be doing this in the FEMA camps. The body registers exposures and logs them in the epigenome. We are just beginning to understand this rich biographical record that we carry around inside of us. We hope that with the capabilities developed within ECHO, someone in the field will immediately know if a suspected adversary has handled or been exposed to a biological threat agent. The same technology could also serve as a diagnostic tool for our troops, of course it could, to diagnose infectious disease or reveal exposure to threat agents so that medical countermeasures can be applied in time to make a difference. All right, so now let's step on to the next story I have queued up. Custom-built DNA could be used as a sensor probe as well. Researchers believe that DNA, which is the molecule that stores information about life, could one day be used as a type of sensor to record information based on its surroundings. Synthetic DNA, and that is not produced in an organism and not containing genetic information of a species, but one created in the laboratory, has already been used to store data as sort of a biological hard drive, and we've talked about that as well. But now, MIT researchers Weekston Tang and David Liu says that their camera system, and we read about this before, this is part of CRISPR, acronym for CRISPR-mediated analog multi-event recording apparatus, makes bacteria able to record their surroundings. These microbes are able to sense and note their DNA, in their DNA, the presence or absence of sunlight, antibiotics, and nutrients in their vicinity, and they could do all other kinds of things. Audio or video recorders, in effect, translate information, and the composition and complexity of photons and sound waves are transformed in a way that is possible to store. And reading the device then retrieves that information. Well, the same principles apply in DNA, and in this case, there are two technologies that made this possible. The first one is CRISPR, of course. CRISPR can target DNA sequences precisely. In camera one, CRISPR works by breaking down one of the two circular DNA pieces. And using camera two, CRISPR makes small changes to the original DNA sequence, snippety snip. And the second technology is DNA sequencing, and in particular, next generation sequencing. So look out, people, because they are trying to get this stuff into us. So, all right. So we've talked about how they want to get people to step right up. And it's all in the name of a cure. It's going to cure cancer. It's going to be able to tell whether or not you've been exposed to a pathogen. So maybe we can cure what ails you. But there are still people, and we read a couple studies where they had done a survey, and people are still not so sure about this. Remember, they tend to target the people that have no other choice, the cancers that are inoperable, the illnesses that are brain wasting, where there's no coming back. And they prey on the desperate for their clinical trials. But how else could they get this into us? Well, I have always had a fear, and I've talked about this before. I read a book by Stephen King in the 70s called The Stand, if anyone has ever read it. I don't know, the movie was kind of crappy, but the book was really damn good. And it was about a pathogen, and I don't know if they ever gave a real name for it, but I think it was called like Captain Trips or something like that. A pathogen, or that's what the population called it, had escaped the CDC because containment failed, and an infected scientist had gotten out and ran to go get his family. and they took off and traveled cross country. They were heading west, and they crashed at a gas station in some little outback Texas town, I think. And the people at the gas station got infected, and then it spread everywhere. I mean, we have questioned many times before some of the safety levels that are going on in these mad science laboratories that are being funded by the Department of Defense at many different institutions, not only academic, but also commercial institutions, some of the big tech boys even, all in the name of curing you, all in the name of being able to track disease, and in the name of bagging, tagging, and tracking in a dashboard to keep you healthy, to keep the costs of healthcare down. Well, I ran across a story yesterday, or a couple days ago, I believe, about a new series, and I caught a couple episodes of this. Again, it's on Netflix. Netflix will scare the pants off you. There's some good things I've seen on there. And this series was called The Rain. And it is out of one of the Dutch countries. I think it was out of like Sweden. And they some of it has subtitles. Some of it they've just dubbed the audio. But it's pretty damn good, I have to say. First episode, I was like, wah, 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 wah. But then I watched the second episode, and it started to get into a lot of things that I have thought about in the past. If you remember, we had covered something that was very strange, I don't know, maybe a few months ago, about them coming out and discussing the fact that viruses, and we're talking millions if not billions of them, are falling down from the sky all over planet Earth. We didn't know about that one before. But don't worry about it, Johnny, because they're not harmful to humans. Research shows that viruses that affect microbes are ubiquitous and traveling around the world in the upper atmosphere. Really? That was the first day I'd ever heard of that, and that was one of those moments that I raised an eyebrow, because they just discovered that. It is raining viruses, but don't panic. No, 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 not just yet. Billions of viruses, and this is what they say, get swept up into the atmosphere by dust clouds and water droplets and travel for thousands of miles and then eventually settle back to Earth, according to new research. Now, I listened to an interview yesterday by the biologist. He's actually a virologist at the University of British Columbia, who actually co-authored a study on this, and he was one of the co-discoverers of this scary situation that we are in. His name is Curtis Suttle. And in this interview, one of the things that Curtis said, this was out of a PBS interview, is that this is most certainly a concern, though not a lot of these viruses infect humans. And we're going to look at how I think he is just kind of padding this, because I would beg to differ. But he says that most certainly that dust clouds could be picked up from the north of Africa. What do we have in Africa? Oh, Ebola and things of that nature. And be dropped upon the east coast of the United States. And I postulated about that before, especially if you watch where hurricanes are formed and some of the weather patterns that come off the coast of Africa, spin up on the ocean, whoop, 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 and hit the east coast of the United States. So anyway, this may sound a bit frightening, but almost all of these skyborne viruses are harmless to humans, says Dr. Curtis Suttle, a virologist at the University of British Columbia. These viruses circulating high up in the atmosphere are infecting almost exclusively other microbes, primarily bacteria. Now that sounds quite innocuous, except that we have read about viruses infecting bacteria before, and those are called bacteriophages, or phages for short. We are going to take a look at phages for the rest of the show here. And as to why what Dr. Suttle said here is significant. Now let's get back to Netflix. So there's a new series called The Rain. I don't know. There weren't too many episodes. There may be 8 or 9 of them. And I would highly suggest, if anyone has access to Netflix, to watch it, because it was pretty damn good. But here's a story titled, Is the Rain, and it's talking about the show, A Virus Real? Disease spreading via water is actually a thing. It's official. Humans spend way too much time coming up with extinction scenarios, and this new Netflix series called The Rain is the latest in post-apocalypse drama, except this time, a rainy day is everyone's worst nightmare. But is the virus on the rain real, or just a creative way to kill people? And, you know, I wondered about that, because if they are so worried about rogue actors, and a lot of this technology is available to people who don't necessarily have clearance, who's to say with some of these cloud seeding technologies that they wouldn't be able to do something like this? According to the Danish show page, so yes, it was Danish, the virus appears after a heavy rain and wipes out most of society. But the two siblings, Simone and Rasmus, are lucky to have a smart, maybe paranoid father who's actually working as a virologist on their side who may be able to cure the virus, or he was the one that created it. They hide out in a bunker for 6 years after their father leaves and never returns. Meanwhile, everything around them is crumbled and only a few survivors are left. Fighting over limited resources, they are forced to emerge from their bunker and discover this terrifying new world. Humans need water to live, so a rain-borne virus is very, very scary. Based on the trailers, viewers know a few things are true. One, the virus is absorbed into the bloodstream via rainwater on the skin. Number two, the father said that it was something in the air. And number three, not everyone dies right away. Some people can carry it around as a disease vector and later infect others. Unfortunately, the thought of an airborne virus latching onto the rain isn't that far-fetched. The Weather Channel recently posted an international study for microbial ecology about bacteria and viruses in our atmosphere, and it revealed that millions of viruses are circulating in the air every day. Many of these viruses do return to our atmosphere via the rain, but they aren't viruses like the flu that reproduce or spread among humans. So don't worry about it, because the rain's viruses happening is in real life are pretty slim. But Jewel's going to show you how it's possible. And what would happen if one of these viruses was able to be transmitted from person to person? Well, it would result in pure pandemonium. So now let's get back here. So we had talked about on Friday, mycoplasmas. That was something that they started developing during World War II. Is part of the biowarfare program, and this was the same pathogen that they had discovered in Project Daylily in the Gulf War vets that they assumed that they had gotten from contaminated vaccinations. Between 1942 and the present time, biological warfare research has resulted in more deadly and infectious forms of mycoplasmas. And mycoplasma is a primitive form of bacteria. They extracted this mycoplasma from the Brucellus bacteria, weaponized it, and then actually reduced the disease to a crystalline form. Remember, we had read that they did that research while studying anthrax from the Nazis, and they found that this mycoplasma was mixed in with the anthrax to make it more virulent. Dr. Xingqing Lo, one of America's top researchers, took this disease agent, this mycoplasma, and found that it caused, among other things, AIDS, chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple sclerosis, Wenger's disease, Parkinson's disease, Crohn's colitis, type 1 diabetes, and collagen vascular diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and Alzheimer's. The mycoplasma enters the individual cells of the body depending upon your genetic disposition, and it actually doesn't have a cell wall, so it goes in and it infects like a virus. But it is a bacteria. You may develop neurological diseases if the pathogen destroys certain cells in your brain, or you may develop Crohn's colitis if the pathogen invades and destroys cells in your lower bowel. But once it gets into your cells, it can lie there without discovery, doing nothing, sometimes for 10, 20, 30 years. But if a trauma occurs, like an accident or an illness or a vaccination that doesn't take, the mycoplasma can become triggered. And because it is only the DNA particle of the bacteria, it doesn't have any organelles to produce its own nutrients. So it grows by uptaking performed steriles from its host cell, literally killing the cell, and the cell ruptures, and what gets left is dumped into the bloodstream. Now, there is 90% of the U.S. population is infected by mycoplasmas. Now, let me see here, because I thought I had, and I don't see it here, so I'm going to skip ahead. I thought I had something here about bacteriophages, and actually, maybe it's the Wikipedia entry. Now let's read about bacteriophages. A bacteriophage, also known as a phage, is a virus that infects and replicates within bacteria. Now, remember, those millions, if not billions, of viruses that live in our atmosphere don't necessarily infect humans. They infect other microbes, primarily bacteria. So that would make it a phage. A bacteriophage, also known as a phage, is a virus that infects and replicates within bacteria. The term was derived from bacteria and the Greek to devour. Bacteriophages are composed of proteins that encapsulate a DNA or an RNA genome and may have relatively simple or elaborate structures. And if you saw a bacteriophage, it would scare the pants off of you. If anybody had looked at my newsfeed over the last few days on Twitter, you would have seen a picture when you clicked on it. It actually looks like a little robot, and I did some searches on nanorobots and bacteriophages, and guess what? Back 10 years ago, they were already working on developing synthetic bacteriophages. Their genomes may encode as few as 4 genes and as many as hundreds of genes, and phages replicate within the bacterium following an injection of their genome into its cytoplasm. So this is very much like the Insect Allies program. It is a virus that infects the bacteria, and then it has this little drill structure. It goes in and bzzz, with its little legs. It drills into the cell, into the cytoplasm, I think is what it just said, yes. And then it's got this payload of some sort of genetic material that is held up above, and it pshht, injects it just like it's giving a vaccination, except it's a poison vaccination full of its viral DNA. Bacteriophages are amongst the most common and diverse entities in the biosphere. Bacteriophages are ubiquitous viruses, so they're everywhere, found everywhere that bacteria exists. So imagine if synthetic bacteriophages got out. It is estimated that there are more than 10 to the 31th power bacteriophages on the planet, more than every other organism on Earth, including bacteria combined. Phages are widely distributed in locations populated by bacterial hosts such as soil and the intestines of animals and in the atmosphere. And one of the densest natural sources for phages and other viruses is seawater, where 9 to the 10 to the 8th virons per millimeter have been found in microbial mats at the surface. And one of the things that they said back in the story about viruses in the sky is that they believe that they come from ocean water. So now let's take a step forward so we don't run out of time. The potential dual use of bacteriophage in bioterrorism and biodefense. What? Well, I was also reading about some new therapies that they've developed utilizing bacteriophages in infecting humans in clinical trials. And genetically modifying the DNA to go after cancerous tumors. Of course, it's cancer. To cure you. Bacteriophages are one of the simplest life forms on Earth. They are natural killers of bacteria, and in very large numbers, they are in almost all natural habitats. And one of the other things that they are talking about utilizing bacteriophages for are for antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Remember, they put a lot of time, effort, and money at a federal level into figuring out how to kill antibiotic-resistant bacteria because, of course, it's all your fault for taking too many antibiotics over the years. What they don't tell you is that things such as glyphosate, which is the most used pesticide on planet Earth, is also a potent antibiotic and forms antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the environment. With the ever-increasing threat posed by antibiotic-resistant bacteria, bacteriophages have regained the attention of biomedical scientists, which means that they are experimenting with these in dark laboratories, but few reports have considered the use of bacteriophages in bioterrorism, and that's why we are looking at this now. In this review describes the potential for bacteriophages to be used as bioterrorism agents or tools, as well as in countermeasures against bioterrorism. Now, one of the things that I discovered in one of these other tabbies that I have up here is how they can utilize bacteriophages to genetically modify organisms by modifying the genetic payload in the bacteriophage that then infects the bacteria that makes it more virulent or I don't know, does whatever it wants. They've done all kinds of things with E. coli that then can infect humans. Bacteriophage research history. An Englishman named Edward Twort first discovered bacteriophages in 1915, while in 1917, a Frenchman named Félix Dehérel rediscovered this group of viruses that lyse bacteria and named them bacteriophages, or phages for short. Since their discovery, it sounds like it was during World War I, bacteriophages have been used to treat bacterial infections in humans in Eastern European countries and the former Soviet Union, where a number of encouraging results were obtained, and probably after they used it on humans. As early as 1921, Bergenhag and Maeslin used phage therapy to treat staphylococcal skin infections. And during World War II, bacteriophages were successfully used to treat bacterial infections on the battlefield of the former Soviet Union, and such treatment undoubtedly saved lives of numerous soldiers. Yeah, so of course we weren't experimenting with this as part of our biowarfare program. And in the 1940s, American and French companies began to manufacture bacteriophage products which were primarily used for treating staphylococcus, streptococcus, and E. coli, as well as other pathogenic bacteria, including those causing purulent infections of the skin and mucous membrane, upper respiratory tract infections, as well as ear mastoid infections. The discovery of antibiotics and the rapid increase in the 1940s of antibiotics developed. So bacteriophages as an antibacterial agent gradually faded from people's minds, but the research didn't. Nevertheless, further research and applications of bacteriophage therapy continued in the former Soviet Union and some other Eastern European countries where we have secret labs such as Georgia and Poland. And bacteriophage therapies were not widely accepted in Western countries because their efficacies were variable. In addition, clinical trials using bacteriophages were not always properly designed, and language differences created barriers to communication among scientists and medics in different countries. In recent years, bacteria with multiple antibiotic resistances have become an increasing threat to human health, and prominent examples include the so-called NDM1 expressing superbacteria and an outbreak of lethal E. coli multi-drug resistant strains in Germany. However, a large variety of readily available antibiotics and regulation concerning their use means that newly developed antibiotics cannot be used as first-line drugs, making market capacity limited and profit margins narrow, thus discouraging research and development of new antibiotics by pharmaceutical companies. But don't worry about it. We have this product back from the war. above factors have hindered the pace of research and development, which is now far behind the emergence of bacterial drug resistance, and therefore research for alternatives to antibiotics is gaining strong interest. The natural killers of bacteria, i.e. bacteriophages, have great potential as alternatives to antibiotics. Bacteriophages have made important contributions to the field of molecular biology, and because of their simple structure and their small number of genes, bacteriophages are a good experiment for genetic engineering and for exploring molecular biological processes. In 1952, Hershey and Chase elucidated the genetic function of DNA using the T2 bacterial phage, which established the foundations for eventually confirming that DNA was the primary genetic material. In recognition for this major scientific achievement, in 1969, Alfred Hershey and two other scientists shared a Nobel Prize for this. Bacteriophages and phage-derived products remain useful in research tools in molecular biology. For example, the new T4 DNA lignase, which is an enzyme identified in a T4 bacteriophage, and that is one of those scary ones that has the little legs and the carrier pack on top and the little drill that drills into the cell, in 1967, is still one of the most used enzymes in molecular biology laboratories, and many vectors are also derived from bacteriophages. Bacteriophages is the potential bioterrorism agent or tools. Transduction is one of the main driving forces of horizontal gene transfer in microbial evolution, and it is also an important mechanism for altering bacterial virulence because lysogenic bacteriophages often carry virulence genes. A good example is the vibrio cholera toxin, and that causes food poisoning and is carried by its lysogenic bacteriophage. And I don't know if we want to get into the detail in here, but basically what it does is the bacteriophage goes in and infects a bacteria, and it makes the bacteria more virulent, and then the bacteria infects an organism such as a human, an animal, or a plant. Now, I'm going to run out of time, but I have a bunch of other stories here, but we're going to take a look at something here toward self-assembly of phage-like nanorobots. And this was out of IEEE Explorer. The assembly of DNA nanostructures can allow for promising nanometer-sized machines. Synthetic DNA motifs are known to assemble into a wide range of nanoarchitectures by sequence programming. For the purpose of constructing strictly controlled biological nanomachines, we designed the self-assembly system consisting of DNA strands with the ability of producing a functional molecule. In this work, we demonstrate that DNA motifs can form the program structure without loss of target function, and these indicate that synthetic DNA molecules can provide both a packaging framework and an inner function to construct a phage-like nanorobot. Here's another story out of sciencenews.org. Nanobot viruses tag and round up bacteria in your food and water. Tweaking DNA and adding magnetic nanoparticles create a new tool to test for contaminants. The story is out of New Orleans. Viruses engineered into nanobots can find and separate bacteria from food or water. These viruses, called bacteriophages or just phages, naturally latch onto bacteria to infect them. And by tweaking the phages' DNA and decking them out with magnetic nanoparticles, we can create a toolkit. And they also have these other...
on the track.